Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Australian Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Justin, your host for this episode. At the time of recording, Bitcoin's block height is currently at 723,336, and the Bitcoin price in Australian dollars is 60,650. Today's episode will focus on a summary of recent global and Australian Bitcoin news. I'm joined today by Daniel and Jeremy from hardblock.com.au, Australia's first and oldest Bitcoin-only exchange. Could you both briefly introduce yourself for anyone listening for the first time? Just a little bit about professional background, when you joined Hardblock, and when you found Bitcoin.
Okay, sure. So yeah, my name is Daniel, and I founded Hardblock. I started running it. I started buying and selling Bitcoin in the village in 2014, and obviously I'm still involved as the founder and really helping facilitate the whole team in doing their job.
And you have like a development background or developer?
That's correct. Yeah, development and economics.
How about yourself, Jeremy?
So I'm the product manager for Hardblock. I'm trained as a mechanical engineer, and I've done a few different roles in automotive and supply chain and sustainability. And I got heavily into Bitcoin in 2020, particularly after PayPal announced that they were going to support Bitcoin. And from there, I joined the meetup in Adelaide and met Daniel. And he offered me a job, this job that I've got now. So yeah, that's how I ended up here. And my role is to basically try and make the website as usable and simple as possible.
Great. I joined Hardblock in November 2021, focused on Bitcoin education. My history before that is as a practicing psychologist, and before that, in business management. I got into Bitcoin in 2017, saw it as an investment, and gradually over the course of the next couple of years, learned more about Bitcoin mining, Bitcoin energy, the network, humanitarian effects that it can have in a positive way. And I realized it's more of a revolution rather than an investment. And so I'm here for it. Well, we'll move into the topics for today. We've got some global news, which we'll start first, and then we'll get into some Australian-specific stories. So the first one is, it's been going on for a little while now, a couple of weeks at least, and maybe even a few years if you want to go back really far, but it's about Russia's stance on Bitcoin. So there was a lot of FUD, or fear, uncertainty, and doubt just a couple of weeks ago that Russia may ban Bitcoin because their central bank came out and said, we shouldn't have Bitcoin or cryptocurrency mining. We shouldn't have it as an asset. We shouldn't have it as a currency. It should be banned. The Russian Ministry of Finance later came out and said that they wanted it regulated instead of banned. Vladimir Putin, around the same time, also came out and acknowledged that Russia has some very unique advantages with Bitcoin mining. And he urged the central bank and the Ministry of Finance to get together and come up with something a little bit more amicable. Around that same time, he also mentioned that he believes Russians own around 12% of all cryptocurrency, which would make sense why they want to protect and regulate it. So since all of that, the Russian Central Bank and the Ministry of Finance have agreed to treat Bitcoin more like a currency with stronger regulation, which is positive overall for a Bitcoin adoption. The downside or the nuance to me is that they have a very strong intention of monitoring the network. So they are setting up an organization called Transparent Blockchain to monitor all transactions, which is not that great for user privacy. And how that might work practically is that anytime a user wants to have a self-custodied wallet, a wallet that they hold the keys for, they need to let this Transparent Blockchain know what are their addresses and what are the Bitcoin that they hold, and therefore any transactions this Transparent Blockchain can keep an eye on. So overall, I think good news, but at the same time, there's a bit of nuance to it, and we'll just have to see how that develops. So the next story here around adoption is around the United States. There seems to be a shift in the balance towards adoption, which maybe coincidentally is happening at the same time that Russia's doing the same thing, or maybe the US was going to do this anyway. But I'll just rattle off a few of the things that I've seen just in the last few weeks. We've got the Texas governor saying he wants to make Texas the Bitcoin hub of the world. You've got governor candidates running against him saying the exact same thing. You've got Senator Ted Cruz, who's the senator for Texas, buying the dip and claiming that he dollar cost averages and also supporting those governors' support of Bitcoin. On top of that, an Arizona senator recently proposed to have Bitcoin as a legal tender. A Tennessee state representative introduced a bill to put Bitcoin on its balance sheet. A New Hampshire governor signed an executive order to attract more Bitcoin businesses to their state. And the state of Idaho introduced a bill to define Bitcoin and digital assets as personal property to allow people to have more rights in relation to it. And so all those things are pretty interesting. I've heard some technical debates around the making Bitcoin a legal tender for states. Apparently in the US Constitution, only gold and silver are allowed to be made legal tender by states. However, the US dollar is not backed by gold nor silver. So that opens up the question of, is it perhaps allowed, or is that a point that they're going to try to challenge? Either way, very positive for Bitcoin overall.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing play out here is just how well the incentives work to progress Bitcoin's adoption around the world. And I think one of the things that we really will be interesting to watch is the tension between the states and the federal government in America, because the federal government can just print money to pay their bills, but the states can't do that. They have to balance their budgets, and same with the council. So they're I think wisely trying to figure out, well, how do we preserve our balance sheets while the Federal Reserve prints away all the fiat currency. So that's a very interesting dynamic to keep an eye on.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, game theory being there in terms of once one state gets into Bitcoin, other states will start wanting to get into Bitcoin or trying to front run it. And once a country gets in, I think if you spend enough time on Bitcoin Twitter, you'll hear the phrase game theory quite a lot. And I do feel that that's playing out at the moment with especially Russia and America now in a bit of a race to get Bitcoin or to legalize it in some way.
Yeah, and it's hard for me to believe that Russia doesn't already own Bitcoin in their central bank. I'm sure they're not publicizing it, but it's a country with very good computer knowledge, and they clearly understand Bitcoin, and they're also very strategic. So I find it impossible to think that they actually don't already own it without having divulged it.
Agreed. Another country that's looking, well, not so much at Bitcoin yet, but there was a bit of news recently around President Bukele of El Salvador, who has made Bitcoin legal tender, meeting with President Erdogan of Turkey. And there was a lot of rumors that maybe they would be talking about Bitcoin. Nothing's really come of that so far. However, anyone who's been following the news might have heard that the Turkish lira is in a state of hyperinflation at the moment. And just very recently, the Turkish government canvassed its citizens, encouraging them to sell their gold back to the Turkish government as a way for them to strengthen their dollar. So that's not exactly Bitcoin news by the sounds of it. However, it does relate to Bitcoin history in the sense that Bitcoin has come about to try to remove central authorities from controlling money. And in the United States, there was something called the 6102 Executive Order, and that happened around April 5th, 1933. And what that executive order was about was saying that citizens were not allowed to hold their gold, and they needed to give their gold to the government. Once the government took control of the gold, they increased the price of gold and devalued the currency. And although this Turkish news is saying more like they're encouraging citizens to sell their gold to the Turkish government, some people have tried to extend this out a little bit and say, logically, does this end up being some sort of other 6102 type order for the Turkish government where they perhaps demand the gold from their citizens? We'll have to wait and see. Just as a little bit of trivia for people. So Satoshi Nakamoto, the pseudonymous inventor of Bitcoin, chose his birthday, which is very unlikely to be his real birthday, but he chose to list his birthday as April 5th, 1975. So April 5th is when the 6102 executive order came into place in 1933, and that order was repealed in 1975. So obviously the 6102 order was relatively important to Satoshi Nakamoto because he chose the date and the year that are most relevant to that order.
So I actually didn't know that. So was this on his Bitcoin Talk profile forum?
That's right. Just DuckDuckGo Satoshi Nakamoto birthday, it's listed as April 5th, 1975. And April 5th, 1933 is when it started, but then 1975 is when it ended.
Okay.
Another little bit of trivia. So the Bitcoin mining, every 2 weeks, it's actually every 2016 blocks, which is roughly every 2 weeks, there's a difficulty adjustment which basically tries to make sure that we're not mining blocks too quickly or too slowly. They should always be around 10 minutes. So every 2 weeks, 2016 blocks, that difficulty adjustment occurs. Now, the opposite or the reverse of 2016 is 6102. Could this be a complete coincidence? But given that Satoshi Nakamoto seemed to have this as a relevant point, the 6102 order, maybe it's a bit of an Easter egg that he's included in there to say the block difficulty adjustment is calculated every 2016 blocks, which is the opposite of 6102.
Yeah, I think stuff like that kind of shows to me that Satoshi from the beginning meant Bitcoin as part of its purpose to be as a store of value, you know, and anti-inflationary money. In the previous episode, we discussed how in the white paper, it mentions Bitcoin as an electronic cash system. And some people used that to say, well, the purpose of Bitcoin is just as cash. But clearly things like that show that, yeah, that it was meant not just as cash. It was meant as actual money for and with store value intended.
That's
from
right.
The very beginning.
It's very much baked in to the protocol, isn't it? And even in the Genesis block, there was that iconic line, which I'm going to mess up, but it's something like Bank of England or Chancellor on the brink of second Bank of England bailout, something along those lines, essentially referring to the fact that the government is bailing out misallocation of funds by banks. And they do that by printing more money, devaluing the money, or anyone holding that money, of course. And so he's obviously baked in both the digital gold and digital cash thesis of Bitcoin from a very, very, very early stage. True. So moving on to the next story here, we've got the Bitfinex hack launderers have been arrested. It was a couple in New York, and they've been arrested by the United States Department of Justice for laundering hacked Bitcoin from around 2016. So 2016, Bitfinex, which was a prominent and still is a prominent Bitcoin exchange, had around 120,000 Bitcoin stolen. The value of that at the moment would be around $4.5 billion. And it's been traced through darknet markets, through various Bitcoin mixes, through swaps to Monero and back to Bitcoin, through gift card money laundering type schemes. And over the course of the last, however long that is, 5 or 6 years, they've now tracked down the launderers, and they've managed to confiscate 100,000 Bitcoin so far, which is around $3.6 billion. The money launderers, if you look into them a little bit, they don't seem highly sophisticated, and they had the encrypted keys stored on a cloud server, which is how the Department of Justice managed to find them initially. But interestingly, the US now is one of the largest holders of Bitcoin. They have around 100,000 Bitcoin. So what they do with that, we'll have to see. Daniel, did you have any comments?
Yeah, you said that they had the keys on a cloud server. I'm just wondering about Bitmo. Some of this stuff just seems a bit weird to me, and I haven't read into the details of it. I did see on Twitter it was one of the supposed Z hackers. It's a lady, and she's got a TikTok where she does funny dance moves. It all looks a bit bizarre. And you know, just because she's got a TikTok where she does weird dance moves doesn't mean she's not a hacker. But yeah, I'm just curious how they actually seized the money. Like, do we have any more details about that? I mean, if it was on what kind of cloud server, was it encrypted? If the keys were encrypted?
The keys were encrypted. And so how the encrypted passwords or how the key to get into that was leaked is it's unknown, at least from what I've seen so far. I know that they've been following, because they don't believe that these are the hackers, so they haven't been charged with the Bitfinex hack. They've only been charged with laundering the funds.
Okay.
And there's a lot of different theories about where or how they might have come in control of it, or why they would have kept it on a cloud server. All of that is conjecture at the moment. Nothing's really been confirmed. I guess all we know for sure is that the Department of Justice is treating them as launderers and not the original hackers. But it's still a bit of a mystery, isn't it, in terms of how they ended up being the launderers, how they were entrusted with, you would assume, probably the full amount, the 4.6 or 4.5 billion of Bitcoin, even though they've only just had the $3.6 billion worth of Bitcoin confiscated, they were entrusted with the full amount. There is a bit of speculation to say that perhaps they weren't the only one holding that key, which is why it was on a cloud server, which allows other people to access it if they need to, such as the hackers or other people that might be laundering.
The key was on the cloud server?
Yeah, so I guess it's probably good to define something. So there's the you know, the seed phrase or the key that controls the Bitcoin addresses, and that was encrypted. It was encrypted with a separate key.
Yeah.
And so the US Department of Justice has somehow found what that separate key is. And
was that separate key on the cloud server or just actually encrypted? No.
So just the the encrypted Bitcoin key was on the cloud server, but then the actual key to that encrypted key
was
somewhere else. But that's been discovered along the lines. Perhaps it's been leaked either intentionally or purposely in communication. And at that point, that's when the US has sort of swept in to arrest these two and to confiscate the Bitcoin.
Yeah. So for to me, but something here doesn't completely add up.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, but like, how did they get the key? And some other details, I don't know enough to comment more, but it just seems a bit weird to me.
It seems very weird.
There's a lot on the line now, right? Because there's $4 billion of Bitcoin that really is from Bitfinex that the US government holds. So where that ends up is quite an interesting story to follow.
On that point, Netflix just yesterday has ordered a series about those two launderers and the whole Bitfinex hack. So perhaps in a year or two, we'll get to see a TV show that explains at least what the mainstream narrative is of what happened with that exactly. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's a little bit, maybe suspicious isn't the right word, but weird to me is just the timing of it. Russia announces that they hold a lot of Bitcoin, that they have a strategic advantage with mining Bitcoin, that they're about to regulate Bitcoin as more of a currency. And then almost immediately, America discovers the encryption key for an encrypted key for Bitcoin worth around $4 billion. That's it's a very good coincidence in timing, if you ask me.
Yeah.
Moving on to the last couple of global stories. So we've got two big companies that one of them is KPMG. They've added Bitcoin to their treasury, and one is Tesla, who's retained Bitcoin in their treasury. So KPMG hasn't disclosed how much Bitcoin that they have bought or will buy, but they have mentioned that it's going to be part of their asset reserve strategy in future. Any comments on that?
Yeah, it's interesting that KPMG are also buying Ethereum, which a lot of I'm not aware of any other companies, probably does exist, but what I really hope is there's not some sort of hard fork or something that destroys Ethereum, which impacts negatively on people's perception of Bitcoin. Because I think we all agree holding Ethereum is very risky. But it's the first time I've been aware of a company putting Ethereum on their balance sheet. So again, that will be hopefully not a trend.
Yeah, very true. And there's a lot of companies that have some early involvement with Ethereum as well. I'm not sure if people are aware, but JP Morgan has been involved in some of the early Ethereum funding and some of the early Ethereum scoping. And the World Economic Forum has a member of one of the three Ethereum board members. So there's a bit of that, you know, big corporation, big bank, big investment firms already dabbling a little bit in Ethereum from the early days. And yeah, we'll have to see how that shapes up in terms of whether they hold it as an asset, what they do to influence the network. If they want to, Ethereum would be much more highly influenceable compared to, say, Bitcoin. And we'll just have to watch that space.
Definitely.
In regards to Tesla, just to throw out a couple of numbers, because they have reported a little bit more specifically. So Tesla in 2021 bought around 43,000 Bitcoin, which at the time was valued at $1.5 billion. And now, since the price has gone up, and they did sell a little bit of their Bitcoin, but they still retain about 43,000 Bitcoin. It's now worth around $2 billion. So they've retained it. It's gone up in value, and they haven't mentioned anything about buying more, but that seems to be the way that it goes. People get off zero and then they start to increase their holdings from there. So moving on to the Australian news, there was a couple of scam wallets put on the Google Play Store very recently. One of them was called Wallet Connect. It looked very legitimate, had 4.5 stars in terms of user reviews, had a very legitimate looking company profile. And unfortunately, a lot of users have been downloading that and trying to invest in cryptocurrencies through it, not Bitcoin specifically, but other cryptocurrencies. And so far, the government states that around $375,000 Australian has been lost, but they expect that this is a gross underestimate. And I was just curious. I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about what people might do to try to circumvent that in the Bitcoin space. Just a couple of things off the top of my head. Firstly, it's good to know that no Bitcoin-focused wallets have been involved in this this scam. It's all been other cryptocurrency wallets. So focusing Bitcoin only is probably a good first step. It's also good to make sure you get wallets that are perhaps recommended by another Bitcoiner that's had a bit of practice and used it, as well as focusing on free and open source software, which has the ability for people to independently audit it, either yourself or you can trust the community, which is often very adversarial, has looked into that software itself. For me personally, I tend to use for a mobile wallet. I use either Blue Wallet or Moon Wallet, which is really great for new users, and it has both on-chain Bitcoin and Lightning integration. For more advanced users, there is also Samurai Wallet, which is very privacy-focused, but that's just focused to on-chain Bitcoin. In terms of desktop, I also tend to use Sparrow Wallet, but for new users, I think either Lily Wallet or Blue Wallet on desktop are decent choices.
Yeah, and so I just wanted to add also, you can go to bitcoin.org and we've got a function, choose your wallet, and you can specify what kind of wallet you want, whether it's desktop or mobile, and which operating system, and it has all the pros and cons of the different wallets. So that's bitcoin.org, and then choose your wallet.
That's a great idea. Again, I think as users get closer and further into the space, they will develop their own share of wallets that they prefer to use. But I think going to a trusted source at the moment and keeping it to free open source software is normally a good strategy. So there was another story here, really sad story. This is Australian as well. So a user's exchange account was hacked. And so what happened is a few years ago, he invested around $45,000 into Bitcoin. It grew to around $100,000, and he had intended to retire early. So that was part of his retirement, not the full amount. But unfortunately, because he left that on the exchange and he didn't log back into the exchange for quite a while, just recently when he logged back in to withdraw that money out, he found that the money had already been withdrawn, unfortunately. And how it happened is actually not that uncommon. So his email address, which was linked to the exchange, was compromised. So a hacker got access to his email address. The hacker then requested a password reset from the exchange, which went to that email address. The hacker changed the exchange password, logged into the exchange, and then set up two-factor authentication to lock the original user out. And then the hacker withdrew the funds, which to the exchange would look very much just like the user using their wallet. Now, the thing that makes this relatively common is the fact that the user's data was leaked in a previous data breach that affected over 1 million users. And so both his email and password, which he'd maybe likely used for another service, and he doesn't change the email or the password very often, allowed the hacker to know what kind of credentials to use. And this person, this user, might not have been individually targeted. This could have been a hacker using all those credentials on as many exchanges as they can find until they eventually get to log into one. The other reason I say this isn't that uncommon is that Chain Analysis has released a report that said in 2021, over $750 million US has been hacked from crypto in similar ways. Any comments on that so far?
Yeah, so I think you're probably thinking, oh, well, that probably won't affect me. You know, I've got 2FA set up on my account. But the thing is, if anyone loses their phone, inside your phone, if someone can access that, it's your 2FA code, your email, and like a browser, probably with all your history or maybe your apps. So yeah, it's definitely not a good idea to store almost any amount of money on an exchange, but certainly large amounts. And that's why we've made our transaction fees much, much lower than the other competing exchanges. So yeah, just have a think about, well, what happens if you lose your phone? What could happen to your Bitcoin? And I think once you kind of go through that mindset, then you quickly realize maybe you need to use an old phone for the 2FA code, or better yet, just use cold storage.
Yeah, the other thing to know about 2FA, second factor on exchanges, it's only as useful as the policy of exchange. By that, what I mean is most exchanges, if you go to them and tell them you lost your second factor, they'll have some kind of process to allow you back into your account, which is makes it good from a usability perspective, but that could potentially be a hacker contacting the exchange saying they lost the 2FA, pretending to be somebody else. So it actually, you know, it's worth knowing that. And it's worth knowing what the policy of exchange is in terms of lost second factor. And obviously it's not easy, like at Hardblock, obviously it's not easy to do. We do have a process where we co-op the customer. We have like a waiting period and we try to get a selfie just to make sure it is the real person. But yeah, it's something to be aware of. I think probably the main point of what I'm saying is, even if you have second factor installed on an exchange wallet, you'll probably get better security for reasons like that, hosting it on, having your Bitcoins on a hardware wallet or something, kind of similar cold storage. That's why exchange with second factor isn't a replacement for the security of a hardware wallet.
Absolutely. I've put a couple of rules here that I think some users could abide by and circumvent a lot of these risks, or at least mitigate them. So one is exactly that, Daniel. You know, don't keep your Bitcoin on an exchange or a third-party platform. Withdraw it to self-custody, preferably a hardware wallet, cold storage wallet. You know, when in doubt, remember the phrase that you'll probably hear a lot in Bitcoin: not your keys, not your coin. If you're trusting your keys with someone else, they are the owner of your Bitcoin at that point. The other one would be having strong and unique passwords on both the exchange and the separate email account linked to the exchange. You could use something like Bitwarden or another free open source software to help with password management, to make that process a little bit easier, because we're not suggesting that everyone try to remember very, very complex and unique passwords, but instead up their password game by employing something like a password manager, where they can very easily use strong and unique passwords for everything. The other point is two-factor authentication, of course, but if you're right, Daniel, that does have some loopholes in it where it depends on the exchange's policies as well. But having two-factor authentication on both the email and the exchange accounts would have been a good additional level of security for this user. And yep. Again, there's a lot of apps that could do that, like Aegis Authenticator or Trilio Authy, or even just Google Authenticator. It helps. If the exchange allows for it as well, another thing that can be useful is enabling email notifications for any kind of drastic exchange activity, like perhaps money being sent in or money being sent out. That's not always possible, but if it is, it can be a useful way to be alerted if someone's logging into your account or transacting on your account, or at least attempting to. Another one which gets a little bit more complicated and a little bit more cumbersome is having a separate email address for your exchange accounts. So most people have what I would call like a daily driver in terms of their email. It's the one that they use for everything else. I would say anything that's very sensitive, like a Bitcoin exchange, have that on a separate email. That way, if anyone compromises your original email, they don't get access to your exchange-related email. If you follow at least a portion of those strategies, generally you would be protected against a hack like this, especially if you're using strong and unique passwords on every login that you use. Well, the last point of news that we have here is maybe what feels like the most significant in Australia at the moment is the CPI was released. So the year-on-year or annual CPI as at January this year, 2022, is listed at 3.5%. However, CPI and inflation even though CPI is the consumer price index and it's meant to be a measure of inflation, they are slightly different things. So I want to perhaps just mention what CPI is, what I feel what the problems with CPI might be, and then maybe some better ways to look at inflation. So CPI is just defined, and again, that's consumer price index. It's a subjective basket of goods that aims to measure the value of the dollar. So if CPI goes up, that means the prices of goods and services are also going up, and that means the dollar value is going down. So 3.5% means that the value of the dollar has decreased in terms of its spending power by about that amount over the last year. So that might sound like a relatively straightforward system, and it's nice and simple, but the problem is because that's a subjective basket of goods, the basket changes. And one of probably the best examples of this might be that land was removed from property prices in the 1970s. However, the buildings themselves of properties remained in the CPI basket of goods. Now, the buildings of properties, the structure, is actually something that depreciates over time because it has maintenance and repair costs, whereas land is often the one that appreciates. But by removing it from the CPI, we get some misleading statistics of how much, say, property is going up. And around this same time, there was some new stats that came out from domain sales that indicated that Adelaide properties are up around 27.5% over the last year. Canberra properties are up 36.6% over the last year. Sydney's up 33%. And that's obviously grossly different to 3.5% CPI. I was just curious because Jeremy's written an article about this for Hardblock, which I'll link in the show notes, and it talks a little bit more about what are the things to look at when trying to gauge real inflation, not just the CPI, which is the lowest possible figure of inflation. Jeremy, did you have any comments on that?
Yeah, for sure. So I think at the moment, if you read the papers, there's kind of this narrative that COVID has caused these supply chain issues, and that's why we have inflation at the moment. I mean, there's a couple of things there. 3.5 doesn't sound terrible, but you know, if you try to get a term deposit at the moment, you probably get 0.25%. So if you do that over a long enough period of time, you go backwards very quickly. But the other thing is there's two kind of major factors that are, unfortunately, I think, going to make the inflation much worse. And both are driven by the lack of investment in oil and gas fields, which probably sounds like an antiquated thing to do, but natural gas is a key input to make fertilizer, which we need to grow our food. And all of the trucks and ships in the world need diesel to transport our food and everything else that we buy. And already I'm seeing worrying signs in the price of oil and even natural gas that I think are going to get far worse. And you will see that not just when you fill up your car, but everything you buy at the supermarket has to be transported there in a truck that needs to buy diesel. So there'll be a lag because, you know, things, prices don't go up straight away. But I think over the course of this year, things that we just buy every day are going to go up in a surprising amount.
Very true. And I recall from reading an article as well, you do hit on that point, energy prices and the fact that, I mean, we use them directly, energy, but then we also have that as a part of our goods. And so that is a really good thing to look at, the prices of energy in terms of what is CPI really at, or sorry, what is inflation really at. On top of that, you mentioned even the producer price index, which is what producers are paying before it then gets to the consumer. And often enough, the producer price index is more than the consumer price index. Given the producer price index is more of a leading indicator, that's a good one to keep an eye on to know what are the downstream flows of that inflation going to be, you know, for the consumer.
Yeah, definitely. And when I wrote that article, just like if you were to look in Europe, the producer price index, I was in the teens, like, you know, it was over double digits. And so the expectation is you would see that flow into the CPI a few months later. But you know, nothing has really changed in terms of thinking that will come down. In fact, the way the price of energy is going, I think that will probably even go up further. So, but as I was saying, there's that kind of lag between, you know, if you think about a producer like a truck driver is producing transport, that driver has to buy petrol today at the current price. But we're not going to see that impact our prices that we pay and until quite a bit later on.
Very true. Another point that you note in your article that is good for people to keep in mind is the monetary inflation rate. So the rate at which the money supply is expanding. And over the last few years, it's been increasing every year as far back as you go, but over the last, say, 5 to 10 years, it's increasing at a rate close to around 20%, and often a little bit over 20%. And so when you start to look at things like the energy price increases, the producer price index, things like the monetary supply inflation rate, the property price increases, you start to get a much higher number. And it's good to probably look at a cross-section of these things. I've just got a final point or two to make about this that might make it a bit more complicated. But again, this is a pretty complicated topic. And we sometimes in economics try to sum things up with a single number like CPI. And I have a problem with CPI at almost its core level, where it aims to be a unit of measure, but it's unlike any other unit of measure we use for the physical world, like, say, a ruler or a scale to measure weight. What I mean by that is it's a bit of a self-referential loop. So the demand of goods, and therefore the price of goods, is influenced by the value of money. But the CPI is trying to measure the value of money. So to say that another way, a measure that's aiming to measure the value of money is actually influenced by the value of money, because that will influence demand and therefore price of goods. It's a bit weird to think of it that way. Let me maybe give an example of what I mean. So say if meat prices go up, they go from $10 up to $100 for a kilo of meat. What would happen is that would influence people's spending habits. They would likely buy less meat, and they might buy inferior products, which would then influence the CPI measure. And that makes it very contaminated in a lot of ways. Just as a final point, although this was an Australian-focused segment around CPI, it's also useful to know that America's inflation as of February the 10th is at 7.5%. That's measured by the CPI. Their producer price index is around 10%. Most people think that we're insulated from America, but it's useful to know that the Reserve Bank of Australia's reserve assets, the majority of them are foreign currencies, including the US dollar. And that's what's meant to be, in some ways, backing our own currency. On top of that, the International Monetary Fund reports that the global reserves of currencies are around 59% held in US dollars. So US inflation is eroding the entire world's savings, because that's what is by majority backing all of our own independent nations' countries. So something good to keep in mind, even though America seems to be much further ahead in terms of inflation, that does trickle down to us too, and it should be factored into the overall conceptualization of what inflation is and what it means. Any final points before we finish off?
No, I just wanted to say that all I know is my wife keeps complaining about the price of strawberries at the market going up all the time.
Absolutely. The meat is getting very expensive too.
Yeah, much more expensive than last year. And last time when I fueled up my car with diesel, I got a heart attack.
Absolutely. Agreed.
I don't need to say anything about house prices, but everybody knows that already.
True. It's a sad state of affairs, unfortunately, and it looks like it's going to keep going that way for a while. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. Please, as usual, like, share, and subscribe if you enjoyed the content. And please let us know in the comments or reach out to us on Twitter if you have any sort of feedback or content requests. Our Twitter handle is HardBlockBTC. That's all one word, HardBlockBTC. Thanks for listening, and catch you next time.